Well, in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in. On the program today, we're going to talk about alien species. Alan Burdick, a senior editor for Discover Magazine, is our guest. He is the author of the new book, Out of Eden, An Odyssey of Ecological Invasion. The book asks, what is nature? What is natural? Let me share with you an excerpt from the book's description. Now, as never before, exotic animals and plants are crossing the globe, borne on the swelling tide of human traffic, to places where nature never intended them to be. Bird-eating snakes hitchhike to Hawaii in the landing gear of airliners. Pernicious European zebra mussels riding in ships' ballast water disrupt aquatic ecosystems across the United States. Feral camels plague Australia, as do poisonous foreign toads. Giant Indonesian pythons lurk beneath homes in suburban Miami. As alien species jump from place to place and increasingly crowd native and endangered species out of existence, biologists speak fearfully of the homogenization of the world. That's from the description of Out of Eden. Be prepared for some strange tales this afternoon, like that hitchhiking snake. It is one hardy snake. Burdick tells the story in Out of Eden of a military officer who shipped a washing machine home to Texas from his previous posting on Guam. He packs the machine in Guam and ships it home. Several months go by before he unpacks it. Opening the lid, he finds the snake, a brown tree snake, alive, Burdick writes, with nothing for company or nourishment but a small pool of water. This is months go by, and that snake makes it from Guam to Texas. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. In addition to his work for Discover, Alan Burdick has written for several other publications, including the New York Times Magazine, Harper's, and Natural History. His work has received a number of honors, among them inclusion in the 2003 Best American Science and Nature Writing Anthology. Out of Eden, An Odyssey of Ecological Invasion is Alan Burdick's first book. The publisher is Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. And you can find our guest, Alan Burdick, on the web at www.aburdick.com. That's aburdick.com. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Mr. Burdick, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Celeste. Thank you.
Tell us about that snake.
Ah, the snake, the brown tree snake. Originally from Australia, makes its way to the island of Guam right after World War II in a lot of sort of wartime surplus. It's being shipped back from the island front. And over the course of 50 years, proliferates such that, you know, once upon a time, Guam had no snakes at all. Now they have more snakes per square mile than anywhere else in the world. And this snake, which, you know, in Australia is sort of small potatoes in the world of nasty snakes, doesn't grow more than about 3 feet long. In Guam, it grows up to 11 or 12 feet long, and it does things that no snake has ever been known to do before, like eat garbage, eat raw hamburger. It'll eat the foam plate that the hamburger comes on. And it has eaten pretty much every bird on the island of Guam and driven two endangered species extinct. And it's begun to spread to other islands, including to Hawaii, where on several occasions it seems to have arrived by crawling up into the wheel wells of airplanes and dropping out at the airport. And the sort of scary thing about it is that it took Guam, it took biologists about 30 or 40 years, actually, to realize that they knew they had a few snakes around. They didn't know how many, and they didn't realize that it was the snake that was decimating the bird population. And Hawaii now fears, you know, we've seen 8 or 9 over the course of the last 15 years. You know, are those just single examples, or are they, you know, just sort of the tip of the iceberg of a whole mess of snakes that may be here and now impossible to remove?
Yeah. If this snake gains a foothold in Hawaii, what will it mean?
Well, it could be trouble for the bird population. I mean, Hawaii has something like 40% of the birds on the nation's endangered species list. At the same time, you know, those birds are sort of already in retreat from a number of other alien species, like alien malaria, which is an introduced parasite that arrived with introduced songbirds and is carried by an introduced mosquito. So those birds really live, you know, pretty high up, 4,500, 5,000 feet elevation mark, which may in the end be too cold for something like this snake to get to. But, you know, still, this snake is like a rat, you know, effectively. And there are plenty of other animals out there that could do without it.
Hmm. You mentioned that in Australia the snake is small potatoes. It must have natural enemies then in Australia that aren't on Guam or Hawaii.
It does it. You know, there are a whole suite of microbes and pathogens that scientists even now are sort of looking into, trying to figure out what they are. It's preyed on in Australia by other meaner snakes, like, you know, the king cobra. So, you know, if one was going to introduce some sort of predator to get rid of this snake on Guam, you would effectively be introducing a snake that is even worse and unpleasant.
Crikey.
Yeah.
Hawaii is a beautiful place, and it draws visitors from around the world. How does the Hawaiian Department of Agriculture deal with the threat of alien species like this snake? There's got to be other threats as well to the islands.
Yeah, this threat in particular they deal with by, on Guam, there's sort of a semi-porous system of, you know, agricultural inspectors and snake-sniffing dogs that try to sniff out cargo and planes that are on their way to Hawaii, and there's a similar sort of, human dog net waiting for them in Hawaii, which has problems of its own. But, in the meantime, there are all sorts of insects and plants coming in. They deal with it in part by having essentially a blacklist of plants and animals that are not allowed entry. If you decide to bring in a tarantula in a brown paper bag, which at least one person has tried to do, and they catch you or they catch the tarantula, then they'll store it away in their headquarters. But often they're talking about insects and things that fly and things that are hard to really catch. But I have to say, I'm impressed with how hard they're working to stem the tide.
Yeah. You note in the book that alien species are prevalent in the public eye. So why is it, do you suppose, that we're so drawn to taking the tarantula in the paper bag to a place where we shouldn't be taking it?
Well, that was really kind of the key question I was interested in when I got into the subject is, Why do we move things around, and mm-hmm. why do we move around? I mean, it was interesting to me, and sort of paradoxically compelling to me, that the main mode of transportation that takes me to Hawaii and me to Guam to see the snake is the same mode of transportation that the snake is using to get around. So in a way, these things are sort of reflections of us and our urge to move. But I don't know what it is. You know, we come to Hawaii, or we come, you know, we came to the United States however long ago, and we brought some animals and plants with us for agriculture or for company. And then, you know, it's like we can't really, we like the idea of wild, untouched nature, but we can't really live in it. It makes us uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. It makes us lonely. So we clear a little space around ourselves, and, you know, we bring along some creatures that, you know, that are familiar to us, just to make the place feel a little bit more like home. And pretty soon, you know, the place we're living in isn't wild and untouched by us anymore. So then we got to keep moving to find that wild, untouched place, which, of course, we can never live in. We can only beat back. It's just sort of a tremendous paradox of, you know, the history of humans on this planet.
Mm. So we're the number one invasive species.
We certainly are. And, I mean, technically, alien species are defined as species that are moved by us. You know, if a bird makes its way to Hawaii without our assistance, then it's, you know, at least by most definitions, not, well, I wouldn't say it's not an alien, but its introduction wouldn't be considered unnatural. It's only our movement that makes it unnatural.
Yeah. Well, we build, we garden, we travel, we've domesticated animals, we modify organisms genetically. So where we stand today, you know, what, this is one of the questions that you set out to address in your book, what is nature, what is wilderness, what's our place?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think the difficult and challenging fact of the alien species problem is that, you know, the more that scientists study these things, the more it becomes clear that that nature, in effect, has always been changing. It's constantly in flux. You know, there is no such thing as a balanced ecosystem. You know, there are ecosystems that remain composed of the same species for longer or shorter periods of time. You know, for one or another reason, you know, but nothing's permanent. There's nothing that doesn't change. What we are doing is introducing more change more quickly, and it certainly alters the ecosystems we see around us. You know, I think where I kind of come out in the book is that, you know, that change is not necessarily unnatural, insofar as, you know, we still got green stuff growing, but it's not necessarily desirable. And then in a way, you know, the old dichotomy of natural and unnatural, I found, was really not a helpful way to think about why alien species are a problem and you know, what the stakes are, really, for us.
Yeah, that dichotomy of natural versus unnatural, you know, that's like the native species and the alien species, bad guys and good guys. You've got that dichotomy going as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Which, you know, you quickly find is very blurry. I mean, something like, you know, something like the brown tree snake, eating all the native birds on Guam is a very clear-cut case. But now, on the mainland in the U.S., one of the biggest threats to the native bird population is another creature that we don't typically think of as being alien, but which technically is, and that's the house cat,
mm-hmm.
pet house cats and feral house cats, which, you know, have their roots in Asia and Africa. But we like cats, so they're not really alien. And often when we talk about the threat that introduced insects cause to, agricultural plants, citrus crops and corn crops, those crops are all introduced too. So we've got introduced plants attacking other introduced plants. Oftentimes the solution that we find is something called biological control, where we've got a troublesome insect that we don't like doing something to an introduced plant that we do like, so we introduce some other insect from the other insect's native range to try to attack the first insect, and we're sort of in this web where at least in the immediate world around us, alien and native don't really seem to mean very much, and it often takes going to a place like Hawaii and seeing ecosystems that have not changed in thousands of years to understand, what a really kind of rich ecosystem full of native species looks like.
Yeah. Here in the Midwest, you say those words, alien species, and I bet people can name a couple right off the bat. The zebra mussel.
Mm-hmm.
Asian longhorn beetle.
Mm-hmm.
Garlic mustard.
Yep.
Poison hemlock. And as you mentioned, the feral cat.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
How do we sort through these things issue by issue, and make sense of our backyard, of our cities, of the rural landscape, and on and on?
Well, I mean, I guess I would say it takes, even though, it's true that ecosystems are, have always been changing and nature is constantly in flux, and that we're sort of introducing, we're just simply introducing more change. But there is an argument to be said for trying to slow it down a little bit. I mean, in a sense, I kind of came out of the book thinking, well, maybe the way to think about nature or our relationship to nature is more like our relationship to time, that what we're trying to preserve are, we're trying to preserve a sense of the vastness of time, of ecosystems that have grown up together over, 1,000 or 10,000 or a million years, compared to those that, we threw together accidentally yesterday. And, it may be on a kind of a minute scientific level that there isn't a lot of kind of measurable practical difference between, an ecosystem that looks like Central Park and an ecosystem that looks like the rainforest of Hawaii. But there is there's a real aesthetic difference. And it takes, it sort of takes thinking about it. It takes going out there and thinking about, well, what used to live here? And again, maybe what used to live here isn't necessarily better, but I do think it's better for the notion that there was a time in which these things moved around without us. And even if all we're doing is preserving a larger sense of time, I think that's important. I mean, it's like, the Art Institute in Chicago or the Metropolitan Museum in New York. You've got these sort of amazing statues, you know, 2,000, 3,000 years old. They're sort of beautiful, and they strike us because they represent the vastness of time. And, you know, maybe that's a kind of a dumb aesthetic reason, but I think it's very important to thinking about who we are.
Hmm.
Another way to think about it is one scientist said to me was, look, you know, it's like our identities are at stake. You know, when you talk about where you come from, you look out the window and you look at the plants and the animals, and, you know, and that defines for you your sense of place. And, you know, and the more that we move things around, the more you see pigeons everywhere and squirrels everywhere and zebra mussels everywhere, all these places begin to look more and more alike. I mean, it's like having Walmart everywhere. There's nothing wrong with Walmart, and, you know,
Well, some people might argue with you, but...
Well, you're right. I mean, but, you know, lots of people like having Walmart in their neighborhood.
Otherwise, Walmart wouldn't be Walmart.
Right. But it's only when you kind of travel out of your own neighborhood and go to other neighborhoods and realize, gosh, where I, you know, my surroundings aren't nearly as unique as I thought, or maybe as unique as they used to be. Something's at risk there. That's what scientists mean by homogenization.
Hmm. It's like when Walmart first opened in China, the Chinese went to shop there thinking that they would find something exotic and foreign from the U.S.
Right.
And it was things that they were making in China.
Yeah. You know, Guam, in addition to having more brown tree snakes than anywhere else in the world, has the largest Kmart in the world.
Hmm. Well, tell us about your experience meeting up with this snake. And I'm assuming that the snake is the species that is gracing the jacket of your book here.
Yes, that's the snake you see on the cover of the book, and it occupies sort of the first third of the book itself on the inside. I should say that, you know, the book, in addition to being about the movement of these species and these questions about what is nature and what is our relationship to it, is also kind of a science documentary. I mean, I spent a lot of time with invasion biologists who use the movement of invasions to probe and test various ecological theories that have been around for quite a long time about how ecosystems presumably work and what happens when they fall apart. You know, so I would go to a place like Hawaii or Guam and, you know, not to sort of wander around, but latch on to, you know, one or two biologists who were doing research there. And certainly in the case of Guam, it was essential because, you know, I had read newspaper reports of snakes, you know, dripping from trees like spaghetti in Guam, and just thought, oh, gosh, I'll just go and see them everywhere. But that really isn't what happens. The snake is nocturnal, for one thing, and the snake being a snake is pretty hard to find anyway. So it really took walking through a forest at night with a trained herpetologist to see these things.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, you know, if you saw one in an hour, you were doing well. But I would, you know, walking through by myself, I would never have seen one. We'd sort of creep through the forest, and they would see, you know, kind of a glint of an eye deep in the brush and jump in and grab the snake and pull it out, and then I could see it. But had it been me, I would never have known that there was a snake there.
Yeah. This herpetologist that you met up with, Earl Campbell, he said that, you know, looking for a snake in the forest is sort of like being in a demented Where's Waldo book.
Right.
Really marvelous.
Yeah. And you know, I spent a lot of time, too. Part of the book is the snake and Hawaii and things that invade on land, but I began to spend a lot of time, too, with marine biologists, and that's kind of a more recent field of study for people who study invasions, things that move around in ships, like the zebra mussel, things that have been moving around on ships for, it turns out, thousands of years. And, you know, boy, talk about looking for Waldo. Often, you know, so much of the ocean is made up of microscopic species that are kind of gloopy and difficult to see and difficult to distinguish one from the next. I sort of felt like, you know, Gulliver in Gulliver's Travel, sort of looking down on this tiny, incredibly vast world that scientists are really only kind of beginning to understand and see the scale of. It was quite amazing.
Yeah. Invasion biology now, does this field also include study of viruses, things like avian malaria, avian flu?
It does, and I didn't get too much into that in the book, although I did talk about things like cholera, which has been known to be spread by the movement of ballast water. There was an outbreak in Mobile, Alabama a few years ago that seems to have originated in Peru, and the virus that causes cholera was kind of swept up with a bunch of other plankton into ballast water of a ship and dropped out in the bay in Alabama and infected shellfish there. There's even, on the East Coast now, there's this giant outbreak of red tide, which has been shutting down shellfish, the shellfish industry. And there has been discussion, not so much with this case, but with other red tides, whether red tides are spread in part by ballast water. Why is it that the number of red tides the outbreaks have increased in recent years and seem to track pretty well with the movement of ship traffic? And again, it's just sort of one of those things that so little is known about marine life relative to terrestrial life. And, you know, these things are microscopic and, you know, often the scientific literature doesn't go that far back. It's hard to know often whether a species is native or non-native.
Hmm. Like the, yeah, and whether it's, again, it's like, where's Waldo? What's the woodpecker, the ivory-billed woodpecker that has now shown up?
Right.
Or, well, some people have seen it. Or reported it. It hasn't just shown up.
It hasn't just shown up.
It's been there.
Yeah. I mean, one of the woodpecker is kind of an interesting counterpoint because, I mean, it's a wonderful story, the rediscovery of this organism. But at the same time, you know, so much of, when we talk about biological diversity, so much of what we're talking about are things like, you know, ants and things on a very, very fine textured scale. And the number of scientists who can identify those creatures as they're discovered and declare, oh gosh, you know, we found a new species of ant here, we found a new species of dragonfly over there. Number one, it's harder to do than identifying a giant woodpecker. And number two, you know, the universities that used to fund the departments to train and maintain taxonomists, who are the people who identify biological diversity, are dwindling in number. I mean, it's at the same time that we have species going extinct and biodiversity disappearing, the scientists who can identify it are disappearing. And we're kind of, you know, it's like knowledge is decreasing instead of increasing as it should be.
Yeah, that's sad because when you think about our concern, and on one hand, our concern about alien species have led us to this new field, invasion biology, and we're learning more about ecology and how it works. On the other hand, we're seeing a reduction in the resources for the field.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, another paradox of the woodpecker really is that what allowed it to persist for so long and go undetected from us for 50 years was the fact that it's been hiding out in a giant, essentially impenetrable swamp. I mean, we couldn't see it. It was not easy to see. And one of the things that scientists have been learning about invasive species is that for a long time it was thought that the reason why certain species, like the zebra mussel, invade where they do and when they do has to do with, the incoming species being a better competitor than species that are already on hand, or the recipient environment being somehow vulnerable in a way or weakened because it doesn't have enough species in it or it doesn't have enough native species in it. And that really turns out not to be the case. In fact, the reason why species invade where they do, by and large, is because, and this is going to sound obvious, because we give them the opportunity to invade. The more times the zebra mussel rides a ship in ballast water into the Great Lakes, the more likely it is it will eventually, settle out and reproduce and thrive. I kind of think of it like noodle theory. The more noodles you throw at a wall, the more likely it is that eventually one will stick, regardless of what the wall is made out of and the noodles made out of. So, at the same time we're discovering the woodpecker, we are opening forests up to roads. We're, creating new avenues for us to move in, and by extension, all of the plants and insects and reptiles that come along with us. It's interesting that the policy on alien species, especially things like zebra mussels, these days isn't really sort of trying to stop individual species, because the process of invasion is kind of unpredictable and you never really know what's going to invade where. And it's much more focused on the vectors, things like ships and ballast water, and trying to control the modes of transportation and trying to stop those being carriers of alien species.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, writer and editor Alan Burdick, author of Out of Eden, An Odyssey of Ecological Invasion. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions, comments. I invite you to join the discussion. Give us a phone call, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Alan Burdick, is a senior editor for Discover Magazine. Out of Eden is his first book, the publisher Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. Let's talk with a listener now. Caller in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi. I saw that some of our pests have come in as in the wood of pallets used to make it easier to handle. They put them under piles of stuff that they want to be able to move with a forklift.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether the Asian longhorn beetle came in that way or...
I believe so, yeah.
And so I'm thinking to myself, here we think we're saving all this money by shopping at Walmart, and we may be costing ourselves a lot of money because we're shipping in alien invaders at the same time. What do you think about that theory?
That we're costing ourselves a lot of money?
Well, but because of the global economy and because we're getting so many things from places like China, where we're likely to increase the odds of bringing in things that don't have any natural predators because it's such a different ecology.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that is certainly the case. And so much, I mean, you can track it back to, at the end of the 19th century, before ships had ballast water, they had ballast dirt. And they filled their holds with dirt in order to remain stable in the water. And on the East Coast, the seaports became these huge dumping grounds for dirt from Asia, and not just Asia, but Europe mostly. And then all these exotic plants started springing out of the dirt, and botanical clubs started flocking, and, wow, look at those amazing plants. So yes, you know, you really can track the movement of species and alien species to global trade. It tracks quite closely. That's absolutely right. And you know, we talk about alien species having negative impacts on places like Hawaii and native birds, but you know, they also cost us money in terms of, you know, the trees that we put in our parks, agricultural crops that we care about that we'd rather not have decimated by insects. For all the damage that alien species do to nature, however you want to describe it, ultimately we're the ones who pay.
I saw in the newspaper an article about Scotch broom infesting places in California, and thought it was interesting because it said that it can be traced back to gold miners' thirst for scotch. And they use the scotch broom to package the bottles, keep them from breaking. And when the scotch broom got there and it just sort of tossed it out, the seeds started up. So you can sort of tell where the mining camps were based on where the highest infestations are of this scotch broom, which is apparently causing real problems in California. It seems to be a never-ending problem. I wonder if Alexander brought along some bad things when he went tromping around the major parts of the known world.
Yeah.
Thanks a bunch.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. I remember being out in the Pacific Northwest years ago and seeing that scotch broom and thinking, oh, that's a pretty plant.
Uh-huh.
And my friend said, that's a terrible plant.
Well, I'll tell you, you know, the strangest, most mind-bending alien organism that I found in all of my travels was a microbe that lives in Pasadena, California, in the spacecraft assembly facility where NASA built the Mars rovers that are now on Mars. And NASA is actually quite concerned with making sure that we don't send microbes and other stuff to infect the planets that we inspect, you know, that we visit, in part because, you know, for ecological reasons, but also because, you know, it would be sort of embarrassing if we go all the way to Mars to look for life and discover life that came from Pasadena. So they have a, you know, pretty rigorous decontamination program, and they've got a microbiologist who sort of checks up after the fact to see, you know, what's left over, if there's anything living. And sure enough, you know, life being life, there is still some microbial life in these very clean rooms, including he found at least one species of microbe that evolved in and adapted to the incredibly harsh chemical conditions that NASA created explicitly to get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's this little microbe that eats aluminum. He found it growing on the surface of the one of the Mars rovers that was then under construction. It's got this really thick sort of spore coat that protects it from gamma radiation. And I said, well, you know, you think this thing's still alive? You think it's still up there now on the Mars rovers? He said, well, you know, it's a spore, so it's not really alive. It's kind of in suspended animation, and it's not terraforming. But, yeah, you know, it's probably still up there. It'll be there for, you know, a million or 2 years. And that just, you know, that just amazed me, that, you know, however hard we try, you know, life just wants to follow us and go wherever it can go. Which then is not to say anything goes and we should not care about alien mm-hmm. species, but you know, it did just dawn on me the pervasiveness of the issue.
So are we now in the role, maybe we've always been in this role, but maybe more so now than ever, given how easy it is to travel around the world, and we're talking about tourists in space, are we now in a role as gardener, a global gardener, cosmic gardener, in terms of trying to manage the environment?
We absolutely are, and I would say that we always have been.
Hmm.
Whether we've been conscious of it or not, you know, our relationship to nature has always been to tinker with it and to sort of, on the one hand, fear it and keep it at arm's length, and then, you know, and then kind of revere it for being separate from us, and then trying to embrace it. You know, we're always mussing with it and moving it around and trying to use it to our best advantage. And, you know, and we're still there. And we'll always be there. And the question is, you know, with alien species, you know, not so much are we going to have nature or not have nature. Because, you know, whether, you know, it's nature even if the beach is littered with nothing but zebra mussels. The question really is, what kind of nature do you want? And I think there's a lot to be said for nature that is rich in variety and rich in, you know, diversity from place to place, and rich in species that represent, you know, timescales that date back not just 100 years or 1,000 years, but 10,000 years and a million years. That makes our world a lot more interesting. And if, you know, if that's in the end the only reason you can find a care about alien species, and there are a lot more, but if that's the only one, I still think that's a really good reason to care.
Hmm. Well, also, you don't know what you got till it's gone, to recall Joni Mitchell's lyric. You know, that big yellow taxi has taken away a lot of things.
That's right.
Yeah. In April, a bill was introduced in Congress, the National Aquatic Invasive Species Act of 2005. We just have a minute left here. What would it do, and what are its prospects?
Well, this is a bill that's it's actually kind of a renamed National Invasive Species Act, which was introduced in 1996, expired in 2002, mm. was reintroduced in this form in 2003, and has been just kind of sitting around, mainly due to congressional inertia. So, you know, if folks in Congress can, you know, get up the courage to care about this, then I think the prospects are good. And, you know, again, the impacts of alien species are diverse enough, from, you know, economic to diseases that might infect us, that I really have a hard time understanding why anybody would object to it. And the money's not, you know, I don't know, something like $800 million spread over several million years. Or what am I saying? Spread over several years, that would do things like, you know, test out new methods of treating ballast water in ships, set up monitoring programs in different states to track the invasion and movement of species that we're concerned with as invasives. You know, just one species, the zebra mussel, causes something like $1 billion in economic damage every year by clogging pipes and, you know, requiring a lot of cleanup money. So, you know, $800 million over the course of several years to combat any number of alien species seems like a pretty small investment. and certainly worthwhile.
There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Alan Burdick, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
Alan Burdick is the author of Out of Eden, An Odyssey of Ecological Invasion. It is published, the book is published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. You'll find Alan Burdick on the web at www.aburdick.com. I'm Celeste Quinn. This is the Afternoon Magazine, and it's 8 minutes before 2 o'clock. Let's find out what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
It's Todd Gleason. I'm
back
in the saddle again after a little vacation. The kids got out of school. Thought I'd spend the first week they were out of school with them, and now I'm back in the saddle. Let's take a look at those settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon. Futures didn't do much of anything. In fact, they tried to rally a bit in the bean pit today, up about 8 cents at one time in the nearby contract, of course. Then there were weather forecasts that called for, just a slight chance of rain later in the week, and anything in a weather market can happen and dampen the sentiments at the Chicago Board of Trade, and the bulls just settled back and let things happen this afternoon, down 3 cents in the July beans. The November contract today was off a half cent. Now let's take a look at what happened in the grains floor from the wheat pit this afternoon at the Board of Trade. July futures, a 323 and a quarter high, low at 318 and a half, and a settlement price at 319 and a quarter. They were down 3 and a quarter on the day. September futures, 333, the high, the low at $3.28 and a half. Settlement price at 329 and a quarter, off 3 cents. And December futures down a penny and a quarter today. 343, the high, the low at 339 and a quarter. Settled there in the wheat pit at $3.40 a bushel. Once again, they were down a penny and a quarter. March contract at 351, high, low at $3.49, and settlement price at $3.49 and three quarters of a cent, down 2 and a quarter. And the May wheat at 354 on the high, the low at 353 and a half. May wheat for 2005 settled at $3.53 and a half cents. It was down 1 and a half for the day. From the corn pit nearby, July contract $2.23 and a half, the high, the low at $2.19, settled 220 and a quarter. They were off a half. September's 232 and a half, the high, the low at 228. Settlement price at $2.29 and three quarters, unchanged on the day. December futures down a quarter, 238 and a quarter, the high, or rather the settlement price, the high at 240 and three quarters, and the low at $2.37 in the December contract. Once again, the settlement there at $2.38 and a quarter cents. That red December contract settling down a quarter for the day. March futures, 248 and a half, the high. Low at 245 and a quarter, settlement price at 246 and a half, unchanged in the May contract. 253 and a quarter, the high, the low at 250, settlement price at 251 and a quarter, down a quarter. And July futures, 257 and a half, the high, the low at 254, settled at $2.55, down a quarter for the day. July oats, 144, the high, the low at 141 and three quarters, $1.43 and three quarters, the settlement price for that July contract, up 2 and three quarters. September futures up 1 and a quarter, at a settlement at $1.48. with a high of 48 and a half and a low at 47 cents even. From the soy complex now nearby, July beans, $6.85, the high, the low at 674, settled at 674 and three quarters. They were off 3. August, 686 and a half high, low at 677 and a half, settled at 677 and three quarters, down 2 and a half for the day. September futures, 686 and a half in the bean pit for the high, the low at 679, settled 679 and three quarters, down 1 and three quarters, and the November futures were off a half cent, 692 the high, the low at 684, settled at $6.85 and a half for the November beans. They were off 1/2. January futures, 692 the high, the low at 684 and 1/2. Settlement price at $6.84 and three quarters. They were off a penny and three quarters. In the March of soybeans of 06, 683 the high, the low at 676, and a settlement price at $6.76 and a half. And they were off 3 for the day. For them, the bean meal pit now, 217 the high, the low at 213.20, settled 214.20. They were down a dollar. August bean meal down 140, 217 and 20 the high, the low at 213.60. Settlement price in the bean meal August contract at $214 even. They were down $1.40 for the day. From the bean oil now. Finished down 10 cents, 23.50 the high, the low at 23.02, settled 23.06, down 10, and the August contract, 23.60 the high, the low at 23.18, August soybean oil, $23.19. They were down a nickel for the day. Now, with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange, here's Celeste Quinn.
Thanks, Todd. Mixed day today on the Mercantile Exchange after a higher day yesterday. August feeder cattle, the high today, 113.92.5, the low 112.85, the settlement 113.52.5, that up 27.5. September, 112.60, the high 111.50, the low 112.12.5, the settlement, that up 12.5. October feeder cattle, 111.05, the high, the low, 110.05, the settlement, 110.75, that up 20. June live cattle, 85.50, the high, 84.87.5, the low, 85.05, the settlement, that down 25. August live cattle, 83.77.5, the high, 83.17.5, the low, the settlement, 83.42.5, that down 15. June lean hogs, 68.10, the high today for June hogs, 66.75, the low, the settlement, 66.82.5, that down 157.5. July, 68.70, the high, 67.70, the low, 68.07.5, the settlement, that down 52.5. August, 67.35, the high, the low, 66.40, the settlement, 67.20, that up 17.5. And October lean hogs, 59.25, the high, 58.20, the low, 58.77.5, the settlement, that up 32.5. July belly, 72.45, the high, the low, 70.60, the settlement, 71.75, that down 42.5. The Dow is up 69 points at 10,536. The NASDAQ up 3 at 2079. The S&P 500 6 higher at 1204.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Richie from Bayshore, New York, writes, Dear Dr. Science, why do they paint tree trunks white?
It's to give government employees something to do. Remember, a bored or disgruntled federal worker is more likely to go postal. Even the simplest of tasks gives them the satisfaction of a job well done. Oh, well. Okay, done. Even if it's only half, they're still less likely to take hostages and make outrageous demands. The trees don't mind. They enjoy any attention they can get. Besides, a white trunk just might keep insects away. I mean, might. If so, it's an unintended side effect.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.